From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. President Bush once called North Korea part of an axis of evil. Now the rogue nation wants to prove it's committed to nuclear disarmament and has blown up a reactor tower at its main atomic plant. Plus, the U.S. Supreme Court has had a busy week, including striking down a handgun ban. Today on our Reporters Roundtable, we have Theola LeBay-DeBose, a staff writer for The Washington Post, and Eddie Lard, staff writer for the Birmingham News. Hi, how you doing?
Hello.
Hi, greetings from Birmingham.
Thank you, thank you. So before we go on to other news, I want to talk a little bit about Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. The two are campaigning together today in something called Unity, a town called Unity, New Hampshire. We know there have been some private meetings between the two of them, but this will be their first public campaign appearance together since the primary season ended. Theola, why do you think they're making nice in public now?
Well, there's always this saying, no permanent friends, no permanent enemies. I think it's clear that the Democrats have to unite if they want to win in November, and if they're going so far as to find a town named Unity in order to completely promote unity, I think it's showing that they're really trying to start off on the right foot, because there are lots of challenges ahead, namely, what role will the former President Clinton play as the campaign moves forward? What will happen with Hillary's campaign debt? And also, will her followers follow Obama? So I think that this is a way to at least knock out some of those early questions by just saying, hey, all of us are on the same team.
Eddie, there's a lot of issues here on the table. Hillary Clinton introduced Obama to her top fundraisers, asking them to support him. And in a reverse move, Obama pledged to help Clinton with her campaign debt. Now, you know, remember, she's given over $10 million of her own money to try to fund her campaign. And she received $4,600 from the Obamas, the senator and his wife, Michelle. That's the maximum they can give under federal law. So that's a small bit. But do you think that Obama supporters are going to step up to try to contribute to a campaign which is technically suspended but effectively over?
Well, that is certainly the hope and the intention. You have to remember that a lot of Clinton supporters are a little bit disaffected at this time by what they saw as unfair treatment by the media and some people within the Democratic Party who maybe tried to push her a little bit to get out of the race pretty early. But I think both Obama and Clinton have something or can offer something that the other desperately need. Clinton is about $20 million in debt from a campaign. The initial amount from Obama and Michelle is a gesture that should hope that they hope bring in other monies to help retire some of this debt. Certainly, it's going to take some large contributors in addition to the amount that Obama and Michelle has pledged, but it definitely a start. And I think it's more important that it should go toward healing some wounds. Obama desperately need the Clinton voters. I think there was a poll came out just this week that's showing that probably nearly half of Clinton voters not sure they're going to vote for Obama in the fall election. Obama needs those votes, and they need the rest of the Clinton supporters to come aboard as well.
All right. I want to move on to another topic. North Korea. Yesterday, President Bush announced plans to ease sanctions against North Korea. The country said it was going to dismantle its nuclear programs. North Korea destroyed a nuclear reactor tower at its main atomic plant to show its commitment. Theola, this explosion wasn't scheduled to happen this quickly. Why do you think they imploded this cooling tower so soon? What was their vested interest in making this show?
I think that even North Korea knows that everything is a made-for-TV moment these days. I would like to know how long it takes for this video to shoot at the top of YouTube. I think it's very clear that they wanted to send a signal to the world and also to surprise folks as well to say, hey, we are very serious about this. We will dismantle in a very public way so that there is no doubt how we are committed. And I think it's also important to remember that this is just a first step. And both North Korea and Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State, has said that there are many more steps to follow in terms of this report that North Korea filed. And how detailed is that in terms of the state of their plans, of their program for weapons. So I think that also, again, similar to Clinton and Obama coming together, we have North Korea making a very big opening gesture.
Eddie, we have so much going on in terms of politics. You've got the presidential race. You've got the economic issues that tie in with politics, like gas prices. You have the Iraq war. How much do you think most Americans are plugged into something like the issues with North Korea, where the administration did make quite a point of saying North Korea is, if not an enemy, a problem spot, part of an axis of evil? You know, that's big language. But now that we've seen a bit of a shift, are people really going to plug into that? Not people in Washington, but just people.
That's a difficult question to answer. Obviously, the administration would like to get some credit for bringing disagreement with North Korea, especially after 6 years ago when everything kind of blew apart there, when the president listed North Korea among his axis of evil, and North Korea started a nuclear enrichment program or continued a nuclear enrichment program, and talks kind of fell apart, and the U.S. made a bold statement that it wasn't going to talk individually with North Korea, that it must come in with this multi-nation approach to the negotiation. So I think the administration is really hoping that Bush administration gets some credit, at least for coming to some type of agreement with this. And it also takes some of the heat off. There have been bad news, obviously, on the economy front, the gas prices, but also in Iraq. This week has been a very violent week in Iraq with multiple bombings and shootings. And this has kind of changed the subject a little bit, but it also addresses one of the concerns that people have been critical of administration and not dealing with the Korean problem before now.
Let's go back to something a little closer to home, and that's handguns. The U.S. Supreme Court decided to strike down a ban on handguns. In a 5-4 ruling, the justices said that the Second Amendment guarantees individuals the right to own guns, and it reversed a ban on handguns that's been in place in the District of Columbia for 32 years. Now, Theola, you are working for The Washington Post. There's a lot of disagreement between the city government and the Supreme Court in terms of how this decision has played out. Give us a little sense of what the District of Columbia government has been advocating for and how this ruling might affect that.
Farai, yesterday was just a really electric day in terms of residents, us here at the Post, just really waiting for this decision, because this is something that has been very close to the heart of officials, then also residents. I mean, the people who are fighting for this policy to retain it in terms of keeping the ban, thinking that guns in homes should be kept with trigger locks, really feel like the city has seen so much violence and that this ban is necessary. And then here you have the highest court in the land basically saying, no, we basically think that the Second Amendment gives citizens the right to bear arms, and so we are going to overturn this ban. Obviously, what this does, not only for residents, but then really for city officials, is just have them scrambling now for the next steps. There is already a city council member, Phil Mendelson, who has moved to hold a hearing next week at the city council. He chairs the committee on the judiciary. I mean, basically, rules have to be promulgated. There have to be laws written and then possibly passed and then debate about that. I mean, people just should think that now they can go out and sort of buy a gun and then have it in their homes. And so you're going to have lots of lawyers and clerks and, you know, government workers busy to try to make sense of this ruling for the citizens.
Eddie, what are the ripple effects outside of D.C. proper?
Well, I think some of the reaction has been astonishing. The mayor of D.C. obviously was pretty subdued, but if you go by some of the reaction, like Mayor Richard Daley in Chicago, and he was really more adamant about his disagreement with the ruling. And I'm also intrigued by the reaction of presidential candidate Barack Obama from Chicago. And Chicago has a law very similar to D.C., and the NRA, the National Rifle Association, has already indicated that they're going to go after other gun control legislation throughout the country. And other cities, in Chicago would be very high, I imagine, on that list. In fact, there may have already been I think I may have heard this morning, it already had been some filings filed against the Chicago law. But Obama's reaction was, you know, he's basically kind of agreed with it and said it provides some guidance to local authorities in crafting gun laws. Interesting, Reverend Jesse Jackson was in Birmingham yesterday for a church event, but he was here just moment after the decision was announced, and he was very disappointed in the ruling and said it takes away another tool that law enforcement can use to combat violence in a city. So I think maybe, you know, Obama, being a constitutional lawyer, might agree with the particulars of this ruling, or he also could be looking at the politics of it. Providing individual gun rights, a guarantee individual gun rights, is a very popular issue in most of the country. I think the rates were about 67% of American view the Second Amendment as providing gun rights to an individual, not just as a collective militia, as in the words leading up to the Constitution Amendment.
But, let me get Theola in just very quickly. Do you think that guns are going to be an issue in the 2008 presidential election?
I think they will, given McCain's reaction to the ruling, where he basically pointed to cities like Chicago, just like Eddie said, saying that Chicago's ban infringed upon citizens. I also want to pick up on something else that Eddie said about the police. In D.C., a very popular charge that the police level against criminal is illegal gun possession. It's something that you see in a lot of cases. And so now that may be something that the police may not be able to use so often in so many instances because of this pending change.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for your time. Take care.
Thank you.
Theola LaBaye-DeBose is a staff writer for The Washington Post, and she spoke with us from the studios at The Washington Post. And Eddie Lard is a staff writer for the Birmingham News in Alabama. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Today we continue our series on kids with a look at gifted children. Meet 12-year-old Chelsea Dock. She plays the piano with the skill of a professional many times her age, and her story goes back to her early childhood. Chelsea began taking piano lessons when she was 4.5 years old, and a year later she was winning piano competitions. Here's Chelsea performing when she was only 6 years old. It's beautiful music, but every gift brings challenges. So how does Chelsea and her family deal with them? In a few minutes, we'll talk about how you can tell if your child is gifted. But right now, we're joined by Chelsea Dock and her father, Warren Dock. It's great to have you both on. How you doing?
Fine. Thank you for having us.
Hey, thank Chelsea.
You. Hi.
So I absolutely love your playing. I myself took piano lessons, but I was, let's put it this way, it's not so successful on my end. I may take it up again, but not so much successful right now. So what, when you think about the piano, what does it mean to you?
Well, I think of like a bunch of like different instruments, how it could like mimic it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the piano can kind of be a basis for, I mean, a lot of songwriters use the piano because you can create a whole a scene, and then you can take it and you can add other instruments to it. But how do you hear? Because from what I understand, when you were younger, you weren't really reading music as much as you were just getting up on the piano and playing. Is that right?
Yeah, I've kind of picked it all up by ear.
Mm-hmm. Why? Can you describe what it means to you to be able to hear something and just play it? I mean, most people can't do that.
Well, I'd say I was blessed with the gift because, like, as you say, not a lot of people could do it. So it's like for me to be able to hear stuff and pick it up. Like, I can't play the whole piece, but I could pick like the melody. Then I say I definitely have been blessed with the gift from God.
Warren, when did you first know that your daughter had a talent that was beyond just being a good student or anything that is typical for a kid taking music lessons?
I would say when she was about 3 and a half, because my older siblings were taking structured music lessons at a conservatory. And what she did was she had begun to just go over to the piano and mimic some of the pieces that they were playing without having any lessons. But I still waited about 6 months to a year because, you know, I really didn't understand at the time what I had on my hands. So probably at about 4 years old, I took her to the same teacher that was teaching them, and she immediately took her as a student. And 6 months later, she was playing in public.
Let's talk about that playing in public thing, because it's one thing to be gifted. It's another thing to have the presence and the composure to be out among a group of people. And some kids are shy. They don't like, you know, performing for others. What made you confident that she could deal with being in a situation where other people were observing her?
Well, she made me confident because it was something that she wanted to do. Because before she was even ready to perform in public, she would, you know, she saw her brother and her sisters doing it, and she kept prompting me that she wanted to, you know, go up there and play. And I was always like, well, Chelsea, you don't have any pieces to play right now, you know. So I knew she had the confidence to play in public. And after she did her first performance, it solidified it right there that, you know, she had the ability to perform in front of an audience, regardless of the size.
Regardless of the size, Chelsea, you performed at Madison Square Garden, and so you're kind of up there with the Rolling Stones and all these other rock stars, Bruce Springsteen, you know, as well as these, you know, some of the biggest names in sports. And you were performing, you know, now it's half a lifetime ago for you. Do you remember that evening, and what was it like to you?
Yeah, the first time when I was 6 or 7, that was the most exciting part, because when I got there, it was completely empty, and I was like, oh, this is okay. And then I realized, and I was like, wow, look at all these people. And then the reaction of after I played, just like, I was just like, wow, like kind of overwhelming.
People loved you. Do you play for accolades? Do you play... and there's certainly nothing wrong with that, but do you play for applause or do you play for other reasons?
No, I like performing because, like, I like just, like, sharing my talent and hopefully becoming a positive influence for others.
Do you consider yourself someone who can get along well with other people your age, or do you feel like you don't have a lot in common with them given what you do?
Oh, no, I feel like I can get along perfectly, like, so I can play the piano. They can have a different talent, and we can still get along.
What do you like besides the piano?
Like, everyday things or, like,
everyday
specific?
Things.
Oh, I like the usual stuff, like computer, phones, hanging out with my friends, TV, video games, those things.
Text messaging? Do you text message a lot?
Well, my phone doesn't have texting.
Uh-oh. Dad was smart about that, huh?
Oh, yeah.
You don't want her running up your bill, huh?
Oh, no. One of my other daughters did that, and I learned my lesson.
Right. So how many children do you have, Warren?
I have 5 children.
5 children. And so how does this, I mean, do you ever feel torn between trying to make sure Chelsea has time to have her gifts flourish and making time for all of the kids? Do you ever feel like you have a hard situation there?
Not really, because of the amount of support I get from my other children, and being that they're older than her, 3 of them older than her, they support what we're trying to do. You know, one will help her with her hair, and, you know, they take her shopping, and they also get to enjoy the perks of Chelsea being able to perform certain places, because when she goes, a lot of times it's set up so that the rest of the family, you know, gets to enjoy the situation also.
When you're taking her out on these... you know, these competitions, I presume that requires some logistics, travel, pulling together the money to travel, making sure that someone's there to travel with her. Is that difficult?
Not really, because it's all about preparation. You know, I can't really say it's difficult because of how we basically prepare for whatever we're going to do. And so when the opportunity comes for us to do it, or the situation arises that we have to do the performance, she's usually always ready, and there's no pressure.
Take me through the just complete boring rundown. Like, if there's a performance, let's say there's a performance out of town, what do you have to do? Like, get up in the morning, pack the suitcase, hustle. You know, just give me a sense of what you have to do.
Okay, it depends on the magnitude of the performance. Like when we did the CMAs in Nashville, or if we did the Ellen Show, then that type of preparation we have to be on point because everything, as far as who we're performing for, is very scheduled. So when we did the CMAs, we made sure, for example, we got up in time to get to the airport in time, so we could check our bags and not miss the flight. When we get to the whatever venue we're going to, we make sure we check into the hotel, make sure she's comfortable, make sure our connections are tight with the people who we're going to be performing for, and we meet the necessary members of that personnel, and just kind of like ride with their schedule, because once we get to the venue, they pretty much take over Chelsea, and because they have they have a certain setup that they want her to fit in, so we just make sure that Chelsea's rested and comfortable.
So if you're just joining us, we're talking with Chelsea and Warren Dock. Chelsea is a 12-year-old piano player and child prodigy. And I'm going to bring Donna Ford into the conversation. So she's a professor of education at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. She studies gifted African-American and minority children. Hey, Donna.
Hello.
So hi, Donna.
When you're listening to Chelsea and Warren talk, I asked Warren a little bit about whether or not it ever throws the family off to have someone who's constantly going to competitions. And he's told us, no, that they all work together as a team. But does that ever happen when you have one kid who has a specific talent? Does it ever kind of throw families off?
I think it really depends on the relationship that family members have with each other and family dynamics. So in some families, it can work well, and in other families, it might not work well. I think it also depends on the age of the child. One of the things Warren mentioned was that, I think he said three of the children were older, and so there's less likely to be as much competition with a child who's younger. There's more likely to instead be support.
People use different words, gifted, prodigy, genius. What do those terms really mean on a practical level, and are they interchangeable, or do they mean different things to you?
They mean different things to me. Gifted is at the heart of both being a child prodigy and a genius. So, for example, if you're gifted, it means that you perform that gift or talent is well above someone else. Of the same age, experience, and background. When I think of genius, I think more of someone who is intellectually more advanced or academically more advanced. When I think of prodigy, I think of someone who's much more advanced in terms of visual and performing arts, like playing a musical instrument, voice, dance, chess, and things of that nature. So again, there is a fine difference, but there is a difference.
You were yourself identified as gifted as a child. What were the pros and cons of that?
Socially, there were a lot of cons, I'm sorry. In other words, there was a lot of peer pressure and teasing and jealousy and envy when I, recall my childhood experiences. But there are also positives because you have higher teacher expectations. Parents seem to have higher expectations for you. You seem to, do better in the long run academically and professionally. So being gifted and talented, and I think you said this earlier, every gift and talent comes with some kind of challenge. And, parents and educators really have to work with students to make sure that those challenges don't hold a child back, that instead we're able to nurture the gifts and talents that that individual has.
Chelsea, when you go to school and then also when you go out on the road for competitions and dates, do you often find yourself being the only kid of color in certain situations? Are you looking around now and sort of seeing how race plays out with this? And are you, what do you think about diversity within the kind of work that you do as a pianist?
Well, like when I go out, I usually don't see many minorities or like African American or Hispanic, whatever. I don't know why, because maybe they don't feel like they could do it because they see these other people of different nationality. But I'm starting to notice that if I really show, I can influence other kids into trying to pursue this, whether Asian, Hispanic, African American, Caucasian, whatever.
Warren, how do you deal with the diversity issue within what your daughter does?
Well, the most difficult part I have with this is that the discrimination that she has to deal with, being an African American playing classical music, that's a serious problem. And also, I have a problem with getting the African American community to recognize Chelsea, whereas the other communities in the media have embraced Chelsea by putting her on TV. And you know, you think about the Nashville situation. That's the number one country event where any country artist would you know, dream of performing at, where Chelsea had the opportunity to perform there, the Ellen Show. I mean, she's performed at Madison Square Garden, you know, probably about 7 or 8 times. But when I'm trying to reach out to the African American community to let them know that we have a child prodigy, you know, such as a Philippe Schuler, that we should introduce to our children, I'm having a very difficult time.
I wanted to, first of all, commend Chelsea for trying to bring other people along and be a role model.
Thank you.
I also want to, you're welcome, I also want to reinforce what both of them have said, and that is that there are very few minority students, especially African-American students, identified as gifted. And so in Chelsea's situation, she is less likely to see an African-American who is not just able to play the piano well, but even in school, you're less likely to see African-Americans be identified as gifted, or if they're at the high school level, to participate in advanced placement classes.
Do you think that's because there are not gifted children or because they're not identified?
Every group has individuals at a comparable rate who are gifted, and I really want that to be clear. The problem is too often African-American students are not identified as gifted. We are underrepresented in gifted programs by almost 50%. In other words, African-American students represent about 17% of the school population, but only about 9% of students who've been identified as gifted. So that's close to 50% underrepresentation. The number one way to be identified as gifted is for a teacher to refer you. And at this point, African Americans are the group least likely to be identified as gifted. And then secondly, after you've been referred, you take a test. And depending on what test is chosen, you may not do well. So there are a number of variables, but I want to reiterate that every group, no group has a monopoly on being gifted and talented. African Americans are equally gifted and talented as other groups.
Chelsea,
just not identified.
Exactly. Chelsea, you have accomplished so much at such a young age, and you don't seem like the kind of person who's really setting yourself up to just coast. So what do you want to do in the next 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years?
Well, being that I'm only 12, I'm not quite sure yet. But all
that's
I know,
fair.
Yeah, but all I know is that it is going to involve music.
You love it. And Warren, what do you think about that?
Well, I support her. You know, I've always told her, you know, because I support her academically as well, because she is an A student. And so she's always been an A student. And what Donna was saying was right. They give you these exams to take, and depending on what type of exam it is, depends upon what type of academic situation you can get yourself involved in. But I've always told Chelsea, whatever she wants to do, I'm there to support her. You know, if any time she feels that the music is getting too stressful, you know, we can just do something else. But I know this is something that I just feel it's something she's born to do, and she feels the same way. So I'm just here to support her in any way that I can.
All right.
I like to applaud, you know, I like to applaud you, Warren, for what you just said. In other words, I think sometimes, not always, but sometimes parents can place too much emphasis on that child's gift and talent, and they become obsessed with it.
Absolutely.
And that's about the only thing they appreciate. But when you are able to back off and relax and give Chelsea some options, meaning she's a prodigy at this, but if she loses interest in it, then perhaps it's okay. And then for her to be academically gifted or at least performing well academically, she has a lot to fall back on.
All right.
So that's just one of several strengths.
All right. We have to wrap it up, but this has been a great conversation. I want to thank Donna Ford, professor of education at Vanderbilt University. And she joined us from the studios at Vanderbilt, also talking to Chelsea Dock and her father, Warren Dock, at our New York studios. And coming up, we've got a little bit on a new strategy to prevent AIDS and entertainment news from Allison Samuels. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. There are so many televised award shows these days, but BET knows how to wrangle the talent, and there are plenty of parties where you get the real scoop. We went to some, so did our entertainment guru, Allison Samuels, and we have got the news. Hey, Allison.
Hi.
So the BET Awards were this week. They taped, aired, and there were a whole bunch of this, that, and the others. Tell us about some of the highlights.
The highlight, I think, of the BET Awards, and like you said, the BET Awards are great because they have all the celebrities. It's not like other shows where you're sort of going, who is that? You sort of know who everyone is. But I think for the BET Awards this year, Al Green was the best person. I mean, he really just, you know, he made you realize, you know, there's nobody out there like him anymore.
It was fabulous.
It was amazing. And then Alicia Keys, when she brought, you know, TLC and En Vogue and those girls back on stage, it made me feel old, but nonetheless, they were really good, you know, and they sort of were singing the songs that, you know, you just remember when I think music, all generations say this, but when music was really good, you know, and yeah. Who thought I'd say that about TLC, but I was like, oh, I miss TLC.
They did Waterfalls with Alicia Keys.
Right.
And it's poignant because of Lisa Left Eye Lopez having passed away.
Definitely. And SWV and En Vogue. It was just, yeah, that, I thought that was really good. I mean, where else could you see that but BET Awards?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I thought the staging was pretty amazing,
definitely,
too.
Definitely. Definitely.
So Barack Obama was not at the awards ceremony. He was in the state doing his presidential
right.
candidate thing.
Right.
But there was so much love for Obama. And yes. I posted on our blog about this. Usually it's like God gets the most shout outs, but I think Obama actually did this time.
Mm-hmm.
So how did that unfold from your perspective?
It is amazing what he is able to do. And it's interesting, one aspect of entertainment journalism right now, a lot of those news magazines like Us and everything don't have the same popularity. So that's why they put Obama on the cover this past week. And it's so great for them. It's like people don't want to hear about Britney. They want to talk about Obama. And I think it just shows the shift, I think, in the news and what people are interested in. But no, I think he's brought so much excitement to everybody it's just like, okay, this is going to change the landscape, and I think everybody sort of realizes that.
Now let's talk parties.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a couple, but there were also ones with Usher and Jermaine Dupri. What did you go to, and did it live up to the hype?
Well, the main one, not so much what I went to, but the main one, Mr. Chow, which is the one that I regret that I didn't go to, which was Interscope Records gave when it had a party at Mr. Chow, and supposedly it was just the place to be, just, you know, with Lisa Ray, people getting really drunk, just really a lot of sort of little mishaps here and there. And it's like, it's always the party you don't go to where all the fun happens. That's the part
exactly.
that sort of makes me sort of upset about it. But next year I know which one to go to when I get that invite, like
yeah.
I did last time. I won't turn that one down.
I'm not morally evolved enough not to laugh at people occasionally. So
this is what
that's
I'm saying.
That's always part of the big fun.
No,
you're like,
true.
Oh,
that
yeah,
is true.
Girl,
yeah.
she should not be wearing that.
I saw a lot of that, though.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
The whole
I saw poofy hot pants. They were kind of like a poof skirt, but done in a hot pants style.
So many regrettable.
Regrettable
just
fashion.
Unfortunate
decisions.
That it you was, just sort of go, okay, all right. Just X. You know that X thing they have
yeah,
on Glamour?
Yep.
Yeah. A lot of that.
We saw that. Big girls in small dresses. I love the big girls.
God.
I'm a big girl, but you know, you can't get away with everything when you're a big girl.
You know, as they say, just because they make it in your size doesn't mean you should purchase it.
Exactly.
Right. That's very key.
Speaking of big girls, uh-huh. Jill Scott.
Yes.
Who works her curves fabulously and who actually has designed a big girl bra mm-hmm. for Ashley mm-hmm. Stewart. She got divorced from Lizelle, who of the song Lizelle in
yes,
E-flat,
yes,
which
yes.
is one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
But she's announced she's getting hitched again. Who's the lucky man?
He's a drummer in her band. They call him Little John, but it's not Little John. That Little John is
not that.
Know, yeah, thank God. But, you know, I'm happy for her. I mean, it's one, you know, you sort of wonder because the divorce just came last year. So you sort of wonder if she's not moving a little fast for that. But I think Jill still is one of those people, and particularly in that industry, where it's really hard to be alone. You need that support. You need that constant companionship. And this guy's on the road with her all the time touring. So I think it's sort of a, you know, it's sort of an obvious thing for her to sort of do right now. But just in dealing with Jill over the years, I think she really performs better and has a better, when she writes, she writes better when she's in love and in a relationship. And I think a lot of people are like that, but she really is like that. So I think for her, you know, this may be, you know, second marriage, she may have a third or fourth, but right now she seems to be totally in love with him, announced the engagement on Sunday, was totally beaming, you know, as only Jill Scott can do, because she's really a pretty girl. I really think she's beautiful.
Amazing.
And she know, like you said, she knows how to dress for her size. And I love that. You know, she always looks fabulous and she knows what looks good and what doesn't. But it'll be interesting to see how long this, you know, marriage and how the album will turn out, the next
God
album.
God bless them. God
yes,
bless
definitely.
Them both.
I'm very happy for her. Yes.
Yes. Halle Berry.
Yes.
Speaking of families and, you know, issues like that, she won the Best Actress Award at the BET Awards this week. But a lot of people are asking, why aren't we seeing more of your baby?
Right.
You know, she's got a right to a private life.
Right.
What do you think about, you know, the whole idea that she hasn't kind of shown off her bambino to the public?
It's so weird because we're in a day and time where you wonder, this time you wonder, okay, did they not offer enough money? Because everybody does it. You know, the going figure now for Angelina Jolie and her twins are like, you know, $15 million for pictures. So you sort of wonder, you know, like, why hasn't Halle done it? Have they not offered her? And I sort of, I guess with African Americans, I'm not sure that they get the kind of money or the offers that white celebrities do. And I don't know if that's played a factor in it, or is she just a celebrity that decided, you know, I'm not going to pimp my child out. This is my kid. I'm not going to sell her to the highest bidder. I'm hoping it's that one. But I think that, you know, that is how you get publicity now. And, you know, not that she needs it, but it does sort of fuel the fire for people being interested in you and you being, you know, sort of the talk of the town. So people actually want to go see your next film. So I don't know. It's sort of weird that we haven't seen the baby. And I look at, you know, Tori Spelling. I mean, at this point, they have the baby one day and they're on the cover the next day. It's amazing
gosh.
The way it works.
I agree. Now, Nelson Mandela's 90th birthday is looming, and there have been all these celebrations. Now,
right.
Supermodel Naomi Campbell, who I guess, according to court records, will hit anyone on the head with a cell phone, was supposed to be a presenter at this big concert, but was removed from the list. Give us a quick sense of why.
Well, Mandela was a little upset that when she got arrested the last time, she had on a hat with the numbers, his prison cell number or his inmate number from prison. He was a little disturbed about that. But she didn't present, but she did attend an event last night. So, I mean, you know, I think he was, you know, people were sort of worried about, you know, what it would look like if she was on stage. But she was there because they're very close, she and Mandela, so...
Close enough to get hit with a cell phone.
No,
anyway,
no, she wouldn't hit Mandela. So. that just wouldn't happen.
He can still fight back.
Yeah.
All right, Allison, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Allison Samuels is an award-winning entertainment journalist for Newsweek magazine, and she joined us from our NPR studios in Culver City. Do not forget, you can watch our BET red carpet coverage on our blog, nprnewsandviews.org. We've got interviews with Nelly, Jill Scott, Deborah Lee, Holly Robinson, Pete, Ashanti, and many more. According to the latest numbers, almost half of the people in the U.S. living with HIV or AIDS are black. Thousands more could be infected and not know it. Today is National HIV Testing Day, and a coalition of activists and media groups are launching a campaign to get 1 million African Americans tested by December of 2009. Joining me to talk about the campaign are Eric Wright, known as Little Easy. He's the son of rap pioneer Eazy-E, who died of AIDS in 1995, and Phil Wilson. He's the founder and CEO of the Black AIDS Institute. Gentlemen, thanks for coming here to our studio.
Thank you.
So, Phil, let's start with you. This is the second annual Test 1 Million HIV Awareness Campaign. So what does that really mean? What are you trying to do?
Well, basically, Shira, as you said, you know, 50% of the 1.2 million Americans living with HIV in this country are black, and roughly 50% of them don't know it. Now, so we have people who are living with the disease who don't know that they're HIV positive. So what happens? One, they're more likely to infect other people, but more importantly, they can't get into treatment. You know, and every day, someone in our community is getting sick from HIV. Two people in our community is dying from HIV, and we have to do something to stop it. And this campaign is saying that, you know, if every one of us, the least that we can do, if every one of us knew our HIV status, we could stop it in its track. One test, 1 million people. That's the goal. End the AIDS epidemic. Join the movement.
So, Little Easy, your father was such a huge pioneer in music, in rap, in the California culture.
Yeah.
I'm sure that it's a lot to really live up to, you know, kind of walking in his footsteps. And on your MySpace page, you even make a point of saying that you grew up in the same house he did and,
mm-hmm.
You know, really have lived some of the things that he's lived. But I assume that you are making some different choices about how you deal with being safe with sex.
Exactly.
Tell me about how you got involved and why you got involved with this.
Well, one, because of the fact of, and you just touched on it as far as my father. You know what I mean? Anything that has anything to do with AIDS awareness, AIDS testing, as far as getting the message out there to kids that you need to test yourself or be safe when you're doing so. So, I mean, just with it being my father who's close to me have died of AIDS, you know, I'm hands-on with anything.
When did that grief that you must have felt turn into the desire to do something with that grief that would affect other people positively?
You know, really, I take it to a personal time. And, I'm going to touch on it. When I was in high school and actually got sexually active. And, you know what I mean? Knowing what my father's died of at a young age, it was kind of, you know, just daddy died. So then as I got older and when high school got more educated, I took, you know, health class and everything and started learning. And one before I got sexually active, a female asked me, you know what I mean, with the fact of your father passing from this, you know what I mean, have you ever got tested? And it kind of like, you know, kind of dawned on my heart a little bit, you know what I mean? And so it kind of touched me. And I couldn't say nothing to her because you're just being safe, sweetheart. You know what I mean? And that's the right way. I can't go against what you're saying. So I moved towards it, and I felt like it was a bigger message I need to put out to people. Like, that's safe. That's real good. You know what I mean? Any girl growing up, you know what I mean, tell that man, if you want him to get tested, get tested. You know what I mean? So then I touched on it as I got older through organizations and my stepmother getting me with foundations and just giving charity work out and anything that has to do with it.
And, Phil, don't you find that some people just, in addition to fearing the results, if you turn out to be positive, there's just this kind of embarrassment factor that some people feel? I mean, what do you think are some of the reasons people don't get tested?
Well, I think that are a number of reasons. One is the stigma. They're afraid of what people may think of them. Two, people are not aware the advances we've made in treatment. Now, I've been living with HIV now for 28 years. You know, I'm living proof of what can happen when you have access to care and treatment. And the treatments have improved tremendously. There's help available. My treatment right now is 3 pills once a day. I take 3 pills before I go to bed at night. You know, 10 years ago, I was on death's door. You know, they call my parents and they give me less than 24 hours to live. Since then, I've run 2 marathons. You know, so I think that the two things, they're afraid of the stigma and they don't know that there's something that they can do about it. You know, and I think that we have to deal with both of those things.
Do you think that hearing stories like yours, stories of people who are survivors and, you know, there are so many now long-term survivors who got HIV and who are healthier now and probably than they even were sometimes but when they got HIV, do you think hearing stories like that is also important to put that word out?
I think that it's important for people to know, particularly in our community, that there's hope. There's reason to be hopeful. And most importantly, there's something that you can do, that we can take control of this. You know, now I've done a lot of work in South Africa, and I remember during apartheid that black women would stand at transfer stations and chant, "We're the ones we've been waiting for," because they understood that they couldn't wait for someone else to rescue them. Calvin Rolock used to say, you know, nobody can save us from us but us. And that's what the message of the Test 1 Million campaign is, that black folks, we can save ourselves. And that's what we're asking people, to find out your HIV status, to ask your partners to get tested, to talk about HIV among your family and friends.
Little Easy, what kind of feedback do you get from your friends when they know that you're a part of this campaign to get people tested?
Positive. I mean, it's a good thing, you know what I mean? And it's something that I might get at them about coming out to do and get tested themselves.
Do you think people are being safe? People specifically who are in their 20s like you?
Wow, I wouldn't say. I have a lot of people who are close to me who have seen the slow tactics I have took and the safe tactics I have took that kind of breed on, because, I mean, not to say it like that, but to some people, you know, I mean, I mean, something to look for, look up to. Mm-hmm. So, but the average, my age, no.
And don't young Americans and young African Americans have some of the faster rates of, you know, becoming HIV positive compared to the population?
Absolutely. You know, young adults are one of the fastest growing HIV positive populations among adolescents in America. 70% of the new HIV AIDS cases among adolescents are African American. Now, Little Easy is definitely a role model. Now, his father changed the trajectory of the AIDS epidemic in America. Prior to then, everyone perceived HIV as a white gay disease. And thanks to the fact that the family agreed to release the information about the cause of death of Eazy-E, combined with Magic Johnson, and now Little Eazy taking this message on, it communicates to black folks that this is our problem. These are our people being impacted, and we have to come up with the solutions.
And Eazy-E was, in fact, diagnosed only once he had full-blown AIDS, not when he was just HIV positive. And so part of this is about, you know, when are you diagnosed?
Early diagnosis. You know, if Eazy-E had had the advantage of being diagnosed earlier, he might have been able to live longer. Now, in fact, I was already living with HIV at the point where he was diagnosed, so that you kind of put that into a context. You know, and that's why the work that black organizations like the NAACP and the Urban League and the National Action Network and the Los Angeles Sentinel and KGLH and NPR, you know, the work that you all are doing to raise awareness is so critical. But it's important for every single individual to understand that while it takes two people to transmit the virus, it only takes one person to stop the virus.
And excuse me for interrupting, that was another reason of, you know, me involving myself, because of the fact of me knowing Magic Johnson lived this long, I could have still had my father if you'd have known, you know?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. On that note, gentlemen, thank you so much.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Phil Wilson is the founder and CEO of the Black AIDS Institute, and Eric Wright, a.k.a. Little Eazy, is a hip-hop artist and son of rap pioneer Eazy-E. He's part of the second annual Test 1 Million HIV and AIDS campaign that launches today in Los Angeles, and they both joined us from our NPR studios in Culver City.